Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the January 27th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. With the Iowa caucuses just 5 days away, and with each passing week what seemed to be Hillary Clinton's inevitable path to the Democratic presidential nomination and a likely return to the White House, has become dotted with potholes. According to polls, she now trails Bernie Sanders in both Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states that will make their choices in the 2016 primaries. If Clinton ends up losing to Sanders in Iowa, where she once held a commanding lead, her greed for Wall Street money will have been one of the things that does her in, together with the poor judgment she showed in pursuing that money just a year before the election. Last Friday, she awakened to see a headline in the New York Times, just below the front page fold, entitled, quote, "Clinton's paid speeches to Wall Street animate opponents," and a lengthy article that continued inside did not brush over the details. 9 months after leaving the Obama administration, the Times reporters Nicholas Confessori and Jason Horowitz wrote that for a fee of $275,000, Clinton appeared before the clients of Golden Tree Asset Management. It was what the two reporters described as, quote, the capstone of a lucrative speech-making sprint through Wall Street that earned her more than $2 million in less than 7 months, end quote. While defending the Dodd-Frank rules before the Gold Tree audience as a necessary response to the financial crisis, according to one person who attended, she made clear she viewed Wall Street as a partner in securing the country's economic future, not an enemy. "We have to win together," Clinton reportedly said, "not divide ourselves." In their debate in South Carolina a week ago Sunday, and at campaign appearances in Iowa last week, Sanders charged that Clinton is too personally beholden to Wall Street to effectively rein in its excesses. Last Wednesday, the Times reported, Sanders seemed to mock her sizable speaking fees as borderline bribes from a powerful industry. "You've got to be really, really, really good to get $250,000 for a speech," Sanders said. The attacks gained Sanders his biggest applause lines in Iowa, where the median annual household income was just over $52,000. Later in the program, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to be talking with investigative reporter Robert Perry about another critical aspect of the Clinton versus Sanders campaign that hasn't drawn the same attention, what Perry has described as their attachment to groupthink when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East and Ukraine. In the foreign policy arena, while Sanders may not be as hawkish as Clinton, he has largely bought into the Washington line when it comes to assessing and dealing with America's overseas entanglements. So stay tuned for that. Getting back to what some Clinton allies see as one of her major vulnerabilities, potential voters seem to care less about her position on financial regulation than her personal relationships with Wall Street executives, along with the millions Clinton, her husband Bill, and their family foundation have collected in speaking fees or charitable contributions from banks, hedge funds, and asset managers. Ed Rendell, a former Pennsylvania governor and Clinton supporter, told The Times she would have been better off giving fewer such speeches. Quote, "Although they needed money, I think that Bill was ranking in enough that Hillary didn't have to do it," said Rendell. "To people who earned $200,000 in 7 years, it looks ridiculous," end quote. On January 23rd, Lee Fang of The Intercept reported that, quote, "After Hillary Clinton spoke at a town hall in Manchester, New Hampshire, on Friday, I asked her if she would release the transcripts of her paid speeches to Goldman Sachs. She laughed and turned away," end quote. Together, according to The Times, Hillary and Bill have received more than $125 million from speeches since leaving the White House, $25 million of that in the past 2 years. By coincidence, Haiti, a country where both Clintons have played questionable roles, is once again making headlines. This time it's over the election of a new Haitian president, the first round of which produced such overt corruption that 8 groups of international election observers left the country before the second round was scheduled to be held this past Sunday. They, like the Haitian public, feared the violence that was threatened by the government of President Michel Martelly and the opposition, which demanded that the election be postponed and that Martelly step down when his term ends on February 7th. Other Haitian leaders, political parties, and civic organizations had denounced the first round of voting in October as a fraud-riddled fiasco and protested in the streets to stop the runoff. After spending more than $33 million on the widely discredited election, a huge sum compared with cost of elections elsewhere, the Obama administration pressed for Haiti to go ahead with it, despite the growing chorus of warnings that would lead to bloodshed, and that one of the two remaining candidates, Jude Celestin, was boycotting the vote, leaving Martelly's choice, Jovenel Moïse, the only one in the race. On Sunday, Martelly backed down and postponed the election indefinitely, but that was not enough to defuse the protests. Last October's presidential vote, in which 54 candidates competed, was mired in fraud, according to opposition leaders and human rights groups. The State Department, which had been criticized for supporting the disputed election, issued a statement on Sunday condemning the protest. Quote, "The United States is taking great interest in how elections in Haiti are unfolding," said Deputy Spokesman Mark Toner, "and expects that persons responsible for organizing, financing, or participating in electoral intimidation and violence will be held accountable in accordance with Haitian law," end quote. In the October election, special passes were distributed to 900,000 observers from all political parties who were allowed to vote outside their home precincts, according to the New York Times. Human rights groups said party loyalists used the accreditation to cast multiple ballots. Martelly's choice, banana exporter Jovenel Moïse, came in first with 33% of the vote. Moïse was a virtual unknown, and many members of the opposition believed that the vote had been rigged on his behalf. The government denied the accusations, and the U.S. International Observer Group said quick counts showed the results of the race were accurate, despite the irregularities. Martelly, a former carnival singer, has held no elections during his 5 years in office, even as tens of thousands protested in the streets demanding them. He had nothing to worry about, as Obama administration and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, stood steadfast behind him. It is not surprising that her emails concerning Haiti during that period have yet to be revealed and may never be. As the terms of all Haiti's elected officials eventually expired, Martelly took it upon himself to rule by decree for an entire year. And if there was more than a whisper of criticism from Washington, it wasn't made public. Before the postponement, Martelly went on the air last Thursday to warn that Election Day protests would not be tolerated. While Haitian politicians spent the weekend trying to determine who would lead a transitional government when Martelly's term ends, the president and at least one key supporter made it clear that they wanted to extend his term until a new election is held. That key supporter, Guy Philippe, a Senate candidate whose runoff was also delayed, called for an uprising if the president was forced out. Quote, he said, "I am ready and we are ready to defend the democracy. No transition," he said. "The president will stay and continue his mandate as requested by the law," end quote. Well, speaking of the law, Philippe happens to be a fugitive, currently wanted by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration for conspiracy to import cocaine, for money laundering, and, quote, engaging in monetary transactions in property derived from specified unlawful activity, end quote. This not inconsequential fact was reported by the New York Times, and indeed, his mugshot and charges can be viewed on the DEA's Miami Division website. Why there has been no move to arrest him was not mentioned. Trained by U.S. Special Forces in Ecuador and later identified as a death squad leader, reportedly led the 2004 U.S.-backed coup that ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The source of the Haitian public's ire, President Martelly, was installed in office through behind-the-scenes effort of then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2011 after initially finishing fourth in the first balloting. For most of the previous century, Haiti has been a country in name only, essentially under the thumb of the U.S., the world's last colonial power. Since the 2010 earthquake, both Bill and Hillary have been deeply involved in maintaining that status. Billions of dollars for reconstruction after January 12, 2010 earthquake were managed by Bill Clinton. He has been accused of managing no-bid contacts, of limited transparency to friends and donors of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, many of whom have been big donors to Hillary's presidential campaign and super PACs. Hillary Clinton's brother Tom Rodham last year invested in gold mining interests in Haiti, the first time the country has allowed that in 50 years. The former first couple were dubbed, quote, the King and Queen of Haiti by longtime Haiti observer, former AP journalist and writer Jonathan Katz. "There's no country," writes Katz, "that more clearly illustrates the confusing nexus of Hillary Clinton's State Department and Bill Clinton's foundation than Haiti, America's poorest neighbor. Another critic, Susan Maxine, wrote in the Haiti Sentinel last November that, quote, from 2010 to today, Haiti went from a democracy with roughly 5,000 elected officials nationwide and at every level of government to today a totalitarian regime with only one man, President Michel Martelly, ruling by decree and dictation. From Martelly's accession of power in 2010 to where Haiti is today, it has not been by mistake, mishap, or misunderstanding. In 2010, Maxine wrote, it was the Clinton State Department that single-handedly changed Haiti's election results to bring the raunchy, vulgar musician Michel Martelly to power. Through the United States Agency for International Development, U.S. taxpayers sponsored terrorism in the country. They paid $100,000, she wrote, to the Mouvement Tedcal, a completely political organization that held the most violent of protests in more than a decade in the country. The goal of this, she wrote, was for, quote, Secretary of State Clinton to travel to Haiti and justify bringing the fourth-place candidate Martelly into second place, the second-round runoff elections, and eventually the presidency. It would be Haiti's last election. Before becoming president, Martelly said at least twice publicly that his intention was to destroy Haiti's parliament, and he did, and as Susan Maxine wrote, quote, the United States with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State backed this up. Is it fair to pin all the blame on Hillary Rodham Clinton? Asked another critic, Georgianne Nienaber, writing on Huffington Post. When secrecy, duplicity, and arrogance have been part of U.S. policy toward Haiti, at least since December 17, 1914, when Citigroup, now Citibank, stole Haiti's gold reserves, Marines, she noted, were sent to Haiti to transport $500,000 in gold to the Wall Street vaults of the National City Bank of New York. If the National City Bank's name sounds familiar, it should. It was made forever infamous by General Smedley Butler's recollection of his years in the Marine Corps when he and the Marines served as enforcers for U.S. corporations. From October 4th to November 16, 1921, the Senate held hearings on U.S. intervention in Haiti, with the government printing office publishing the proceedings in which the following telling quote was taken. Quote, from 1804 to 1915, Haiti was a sovereign state under a republican form of government. She won her independence from France in 1804. She was deprived of it in 1915 by the United States. Since then, we have been in virtual control of her territory. Our Marines have been in military occupation of the country, and the former republic has been stripped by us of every vestige of her sovereignty, end quote. The Marines are no longer there, but they have had no shortage of surrogates. Only during the presidency of Jean-Bertrand Aristide as Haiti, the site of the first genuine revolution in the Americas, not been controlled by the United States. In the arena of Israel-U.S. relations, it appeared that a new day might be dawning when on January 18th, U.S. Ambassador to Israel Dan Shapiro criticized the predominantly Jewish state for its adhering to, quote, two standards of law in the West Bank, one for Israelis and another much harsher for Palestinians. Speaking at the Israeli National Institute for Security Studies, Shapiro's words shook the Israeli establishment and Jewish organizations in the U.S., which expect the U.S. ambassador in Israel to follow the actions of the U.S. Congress and put Israel's interests first. Shapiro also said that Washington was, quote, concerned and perplexed over Israel's strategy of building West Bank settlements and that its continued expansion of settlements raises questions about Israel's intentions and its stated commitment to establishing an independent Palestinian state. Shapiro added that Israel had also legalized some West Bank outposts despite pledges to the U.S. not to do so. As Israel's closest friend, the U.S. is steadfast in its support for Israel, he insisted, but it was also its role to call Israel out on its errors. Shapiro observed that Israel restricts Palestinian economic development in the West Bank, and despite its recent indictment against the suspects in a deadly arson attack against a Palestinian family, he bemoaned what he called an inadequate response to settler violence. On Monday, 1 week later, however, Shapiro took to Israel's radio airwaves to apologize. Not for what he said, but for his timing, coming on a day when one West Bank Jewish woman settler was buried and another stabbed. Asked by Israeli Army Radio whether he stands by his comment that there are two standards of law in the West Bank, Shapiro did not answer directly, saying instead, the present reality could lead to a binational reality, quote, which is not in anyone's interest, end quote. He also sidestepped a question about what specific acts of Jewish violence he feels are not being sufficiently investigated. Of course, the time never seems to be right when it comes to criticizing Israel. For their angering Israel, the European Union passed on Monday a resolution stipulating that all agreements between Israel and the EU do not apply to any areas over the 1949 armistice borders, which means the occupied West Bank. In a statement that one right-wing Israeli paper described as convoluted, the EU position read, quote, "The EU expresses its commitment to ensure that, in line with international law, all agreements between the State of Israel and the EU must unequivocally and explicitly indicate their inapplicability to territories occupied by Israel in 1967, end quote. Now, this does not constitute a boycott of Israel, which the EU strongly opposes, it added. That qualification not only did not appease the wrath of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he had the audacity to compare the resolution as being equivalent to the Nazis forcing Jews in Europe to wear a yellow star. Also high on Netanyahu's enemies list is Sweden's foreign minister Margot Wallström. She had the temerity to call for an investigation into whether Israel's recent killings of Palestinians has been extrajudicial, and she doesn't seem to be Israel's chief blowhard, who has denounced her remarks as outrageous, immoral, and stupid. And Netanyahu isn't through yet. Yesterday, he slammed UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon for remarks he made yesterday to the UN Security Council. Quote, said Moon, "Palestinian violence against Israel," he said, "is a result of Palestinian frustration over a half century of occupation and the paralysis of the peace process," end quote. Ban called on Israel to freeze building in the settlements and to apply justice equally for Israelis and Palestinians while condemning the spate of attacks by Palestinians targeting Jewish Israelis. But security measures alone will not stop the violence, Ban said. They cannot address the profound sense of alienation and despair driving some Palestinians, especially young people. It's human nature to react to occupation, which often serves as a potent incubator of hate and extremism, end quote. Netanyahu criticized Ban's remarks, saying they, quote, provide a tailwind for terror. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.